Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And with us to help me field questions, one of our frequent guests and regular contributors, Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin. Layla is a registered dietitian. She also holds a master's degree in nutrition. And she is working together with me on a daily basis to help patients at the Hoffman Center. So that's what we're going to try and do. We have some questions, but first, we send out a weekly newsletter. It's the Intelligent Medicine Newsletter. And my newsletter, I guess it was last week. Last week was, the subject was, repeat after me, hunger is my friend. And it's catching on. It's sort of a mantra. I see people walking around Manhattan saying under their breath, hunger is my friend, hunger is my friend. Kind of like chanting a Buddhist chant. It's going viral. But I put it up on my Facebook page, Layla. I know that you're not a big Facebook person, but it kind of attracted some controversy, and I wanted to put that to you. Of course, the purpose, and you can, by the way, you can check out that article. First of all, subscribe to the newsletter via radio program at AOL.com. Request the newsletter. But also, I put it up on Facebook, and it's on our website at drhoffman.com. So the article's entitled Repeat After Me, Hunger is My Friend. And in that article, I pointed out that a lot of people are very phobic about hunger. They say, oh my goodness, you know, I'm getting hungry, I'm, you know, feeling out of sorts, I got to rush and eat something. And I pointed out that hunger is a part of the human condition. It's part of evolution and what drives us to seek food. It's not something to get too bent out of shape about. And oh, by the way, when you're hungry, you're burning down fat, which is a good thing. So you can read about it in detail. But then people posted, and this is actually kind of a reasonable critique or confusion that arose from that article. People pointed out that one of the common dietary recommendations is make sure you eat frequent small meals to stave off hunger. Because if you get too hungry, it's all game over. You start to eat too much. And one of the strategies for maintaining weight loss is to eat frequent meals, and then don't starve yourself, because you could also slow down your metabolism. That's a second reason not to go into not to go on these fasts or crazy diets and lose scads and scads of weight, because long term it's not productive. So do you have any pushback on those notions? I mean, you saw the article, and I think those are reasonable points to be made.
Yes, they are, and I've heard it, and I've even said so myself earlier in my nutrition career. Here's the thing. To stave off hunger, to eat frequent meals to stave off hunger, I would first ask the question, well, why are we this hungry in the first place? Unfortunately, that becomes a vicious cycle. If you're eating a high-carb, low-fat diet, you're going to be hungry. You may need to nibble on something every 3 hours.
In other words, is it a real hunger or is it a false hunger? Because, a true physiologic hunger is, you know, you're dwindling away your energy stores, and that, you know, nature wants us to maintain our fat reserve against
famine. It's absolutely a false hunger.
Yeah.
And it's caused by erratic blood sugar fluctuations. You know, eat that cereal, that low-fat or non-fat cereal with the skim milk in the morning. You're going to cause a rapid rise in blood sugar and then a crash, and now we're hungry again. But how could that be if you just ate that cereal, you know, at 8 a.m. and it's only 10:30 a.m.? What's
right.
going on there?
It reminds me of what they tell diabetics, you know, when you shoot insulin, and, you know, that's equivalent to maybe producing too much insulin in your own body, like some of these people who crave carbs. They tell you overeat frequent small meals and have snacks and, you know, stave off hunger because your blood sugar is going to crash. And so people, you know, they eat on a schedule.
Yeah. And, you know, insulin-dependent diabetics are probably injecting too much insulin if they've been given the standard dietary advice to make sure they're eating whole grains and fruit and so forth and so on, and have your whole grain bread and everything. So it's unfortunate. I like to see many of our insulin-dependent diabetics are able to administer less insulin. When we put them on a lower-carb diet, they start to lose weight. The inflammation in their body goes down because they're not having to give themselves so much insulin anymore. Insulin is also, you know, the master and commander of the beginning of inflammation, of propagating that inflammation.
Right.
So, as we know. So, yeah, that dietary advice of eat frequently to stave off hunger, yeah, you're going to have to do that if you're going to follow the mainstream advice of low fat, you know, the fat phobia is still out there, and high carb, your whole grains and your whole grains, and my goodness, did I mention your whole grains?
Actually, you know, apropos of that, I mean, I've got the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition in front of me today, and, you know, just out this week, and they have an article on whole grains and body weight changes in apparently healthy adults. In other words, they've been promoting whole grains as a way to help people lose weight. But then we know there's a lot of abuse because what they call a whole grain, you know, a whole grain bagel is not really exactly low glycemic. It's a packs a calorie wallop. So a lot of people, you know, it's not, they're not eating, you know, kasha cereal, but actually buckwheat kasha, mm-hmm. which is a really kind of hard to chew, very time release form of carbohydrate, or even brown rice. But what they're saying here, contrary to what the government tells you and what many nutritionists tell you and what many mainstream organizations like the American Heart Association tell you, in this study, they discovered that whole grains did not help people to lose weight. So, you know, kind of belies that whole strategy that, you know, carbs are carbs. You know, maybe slow release carbs are better than table sugar, but not much.
That's true. I mean, whole grain bread is still processed to some degree, mm-hmm. you know. So we have to make that distinction, too. It's not just a matter of the simple carbohydrates versus the complex carbohydrates anymore. It's also about glycemic load. But the bottom line is anybody trying to lose fat, especially belly fat, they're not going to be helped by any kind of whole grains. And that's just the bottom line. They need to eat more fat. They need to eat more protein. They need to eat more vegetables. And that's essentially it, because those are the food groups that aren't going to cause erratic blood sugar fluctuations and then subsequent rises in insulin. It's that insulin that then puts on, that puts us in fat storage mode.
And, you know, coming back to that mantra of hunger is my friend, you know, typically when people change diets at the Hoffman Center, they do go through a period of deprivation. And, you know, sometimes, you know, we have to deal with that.
Carbohydrate withdrawal.
Right. You're at the brunt of that because, I mean, that's one of the reasons that after many years in practice of purveying nutrition information by myself, I need a nutritionist because, you know, I mean, people are in crisis, literally, and they need to be talked through it. And you do a great job of that. So typically, there is a period where you have hunger, you have withdrawal, but then you kind of emerge to a nice plateau where you become more equanimous about your carb cravings and food intake, doesn't you? Don't you?
That's true. That's true. Especially, you know, we could name how many hundreds of patients with hypoglycemia or unstable blood sugar. And then after a period of time of stabilizing their blood sugar with the proper diet, meaning the proper amounts of fats and proteins, they no longer need those in-between meal snacks anymore. They no longer need to eat every 3 hours or anything like that. They no longer have that adrenal stress they used to have from chronic low blood sugar. So the hunger normalizes. And then any hunger that's experienced thereon in is real physiological hunger.
Yeah,
you know, and that happens after a while.
When you really are,
fast.
We're in proper touch with your body, because the vast majority of people are really not in touch with what their body needs. There are these false cravings, and thereby goes obesity and insulin resistance. Okay, so in this self same issue of the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, you know, a lot of people who are defenders of the vegetarian diet talk about something called the China Study, and they actually made that into a book. It's a book by the renowned nutrition scientist, Dr. Colin Campbell, and he goes around lecturing about vegetarianism, the benefits of vegetarianism, and what he claims in this book, the China Study, and a lot of people who believe in vegan or vegetarian diets, you know, this includes, he also doesn't like dairy, say that that book is proof positive that meat is bad for you and dairy is bad for you. And what he cites is data from China that shows that the cancer rate has gone up since the introduction of meat and animal protein. And therefore, in America, if we reduce our intake of animal protein or eliminate it entirely, that's the answer to heart disease and cancer. And so I was very excited to see in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition an article that comes out of Asia. And the article is, in my opinion, the true China study, because I you know, you'll talk in just a moment about the drawbacks of the China study, because we've been all over that. We've studied it. We've, you know, looked at it and critiqued it. But this new study states that there is absolutely no correlation between the intake of animal protein in Asia and the risk of cardiovascular disease or cancer. And in fact, and the authors, I think they wanted to point out that there was going to be a risk. That was their hypothesis. They found precisely the opposite. Now, this, what we have to say is there has been an increase in the risk of cancer and heart disease in those countries, in China and in Korea and in Japan. And the reason for that is they're more sedentary. They have a more polluted environment. They can afford to buy more cigarettes. You know, perhaps they have more overall calories and they're fatter. And that may be more the fault of carbohydrates than animal protein. But to their disappointment in the study, they found absolutely no correlation, no association between meat intake and the risk of death in Asian countries. And they even found some reverse causation. But what's your comment on that?
Just that, first of all, for the scientists who were expecting a different conclusion and they found out something else, I applaud them for not being married to the thing that they wanted the conclusion to
be.
Right.
And that's what science
really respecting
about.
Science. Yep. Yes, really respecting science. Wow, look at that. We thought it was going to go one way, but it went another.
Thank
this
you for
is about
that.
The
that's
truth
great.
In science.
Yes.
This is the truth in science. This is what we all need to be doing as scientists. So I really, really applaud that. And American Journal of Clinical Nutrition is one of the better journals out there. So but getting to this, first of all, the other thing, if I may point out, in Asian countries, they're switching to more westernized diets. So they also have to look at the amount of carbohydrates that have come in. You know, Asians that are looking more moon-faced in China or something like that. That's something else that needs to be taken into consideration. But no, we're finding more and more that there is no correlation to the fat, the saturated fat intake, the meat intake, and all of our chronic diseases. Really, that's what we're finding out. And the big foe here are the carbohydrates, particularly the refined processed carbohydrates, the amounts of sugar we take in on a yearly basis. It's really, really incredible.
So you've looked at the China study by Colin Campbell, and you know it really makes a very persuasive case. There's charts and there's graphs, and a lot of people read this, and they're not research scientists, but they're intelligent people. They've been to college. They know how to look at a graph, and they know how to follow an argument, and it seems utterly persuasive to them that after reading that book that they should abandon their intake of meat, that they should be on an utterly low-fat diet. I mean, I have actually a friend who's a dentist. And he is, I mean, if you look at him, he looks utterly emaciated. His whole life is about being on a vegan or vegetarian diet. It's very hard for us to figure out a restaurant to go to. And then when we finally get to a restaurant, you know, when we order the side dishes, he'll ask for the sautéed spinach, but he'll say, make sure it's steamed, no oil. know? And but he believes implicitly in the conclusions of the China study, and he believes that this is going to be his key to longevity and wellness. And yet, you know, actually, I'm just reading a little more carefully in this journal article that they found what's called an inverse association between cardiovascular death in men. In other words, there was actually red meat intake seemed to protect against death in men, mm-hmm. and for some reason it protected against death in women in Asian countries. Well, and, you know, they also note in the study one of the limitations is, as in many studies, some studies showing that meat is not good for you, they weren't able to separate out the effects of processed meat from better cuts of meat. Or, you know, certainly there have been very few studies done on, because it's so infrequently used, that, you know, grass-fed beef and,
yes.
You know, that
yes.
kind of thing that we advocate.
Yeah. Well, getting back to your point about the China study, the arguments are well written, so forth and so on. But again, it comes down to questioning the science. Let me bring up Ansel Keys and the whole cholesterol heart disease hypothesis. seven-country study is what he quoted as these are the countries' highest amounts of the lowest amounts of saturated fat, lowest in heart attack. But you know, he originally looked at 22 countries. What happened to the rest of those countries? He didn't include them in there because it didn't jibe with his hypothesis. It didn't jibe with the conclusion right. that he was after.
Like, don't let the facts confuse me.
Exactly. Yeah. But do you see what we're saying here? That the things that are cherry-picked out were then cherry-picked in to, say, the T. Colin Campbell book. But this is really what we're talking about.
Right.
How the scientific research is done. Not many people know. I mean, the Ansel Keys study was the beginning of the whole saturated fat is bad, cholesterol is bad revolution of the past few decades. But what about those countries that weren't included, that didn't have such high rates of heart disease, like the Austrians and the Finns and so forth? And, you know, this was not brought to light until much, much later. Now, in so many books written about the whole cholesterol myth and so forth, Stephen Sinatra and others, among others, Johnny Bowden and so forth. So we're finding out all these things, that there's a lot of flaws in the methodology, that scientists really not, they have to not be in love with their hypothesis and married to it and so forth, that they really have to try their best to be objective, and it's hard to be objective too. That's the reason for double-blind scientific studies, you know. This is what we're talking about. Anybody could write a book about anything based on all the reams of research that's out there, because everything that's published, just because it's published doesn't mean it's true, that it's reliable, that it's replicable, that or that it's valid. And this is what we're dealing with.
And it's our job to really, as nutrition experts, to sort that out for the general public.
We have to pluck out the gems and present them the way that it's supposed to be. This is about the truth in science. Yes.
I mean,
yes.
It happens for me when I need a financial advice. I just don't know what the heck to do. So hopefully other people, study this and have a better idea of how to develop a balanced money portfolio. Similarly, legal mm-hmm. advice. He who hath himself for a lawyer hath a fool for a lawyer.
Yeah,
etc.
Exactly.
So that's why we do what we do in the field of nutrition. Okay, yeah.
Let me just bring out the point a little
sure.
bit more. Because you mentioned financial advice, which is a little bit of a hobby of mine. You know,
yep.
you have to completely scrutinize your financial planner too.
Yes.
You have to know,
have
are
to
they a fiduciary or are they not a fiduciary? Are they making a commission or are they a fee-based financial plan? You have to do all of this kind of homework. You know, to make sure that they have your interests at heart, not their own, and so forth. You know, so there are a lot of things that need a lot of scrutiny, not just in science, but everywhere else.
Right. And, the question is whether professionals out there are selling information
yes.
and that is in the best interest of their clients, or whether they're selling products
yes.
that they're pushed to sell and that they have a conflict of interest and a vested interest in
yeah.
selling. So, this might be said about, vitamins and supplements that we sell to patients, but I sincerely believe that these things have benefits. And, as soon as something turns out to not be beneficial, I'll discard it.
Exactly. And listen, it's not just because we believe they're beneficial. This is not a faith-based system. It's because there is good, solid, reliable, valid scientific research that you and I both look at and say, hey, this is good. Are there more studies that say the same thing? Hey, look at these 100 other studies that say this is good. Here we go. I mean, this is what we have to do every day.
All right, I'm sorry I'm hogging this issue of the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, but once I get done with it, I'll bring it back into the office
yeah.
tomorrow and you can take a look at it. All right, let's move to questions. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. By the way, for questions, email us to radioprogram@AOL.com and state your question. Make it brief, because if it's too complicated, we just won't tackle the question. Make it focused and succinct. radioprogram@AOL.com. Okay, this one comes from Gail. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. I really enjoy your podcast. Listen all the time. Keep up the good work. That's good that she listens, because then she'll hear the answer to her question. because, some people think, well, I'll just email my question and then they'll write me this big long response like a personal answering service. No, we will, in the interest of everyone, your interest, but also in the interest of our listeners, we'll read your question on the air, and then everyone can partake of the hopefully the wisdom. I am really working hard to decrease my sugar consumption. I read labels, focus on low glycemic foods, and stay away from obvious sugar traps. However, I have not solved the dilemma of what to put in my decaf. I feel that my 1 to 2 cups per day is important to my mental well-being. I look forward to it, but am concerned about putting sugar in since I do it once or twice a day. Sugar-free alternatives seem to have their negative side effects, and products like stevia and Truvia have very strong aftertaste as well as mixed reviews. I am told that honey is just as bad as sugar. I'm interested in your opinions about what I am to do. What is my best, safest choice? I really cannot get used to decaf unsweetened. Thank you for your help. By the way, I am a huge drinker. Layla, you know this because in the office, before I can sit down to see patients, I insist on having like a big fresh cup pot of decaf brewed. You know that I actually come to a grinding halt when I don't have my decaf. I never drink it with sugar because if I did, I'd be getting 6 or 7 or 8 servings of sugar every day. So I've learned to drink it without.
Right.
I mean, what would you say to Gail?
Well, Gail, and what's most interesting is the last sentence. I really cannot get used to decaf unsweetened. Okay. Gail, what I say to you is if you don't enjoy the decaf unsweetened, you're probably not a coffee drinker. You're probably not a fan of coffee because what you're saying is that your cup of decaf is a sugar delivery system for you.
That's, you nailed it. Yeah.
So,
because you know, the active ingredient in the coffee has been removed.
Yes.
So you're not getting the caffeine kick. Mm-hmm. So you get a nice flavor and it's warm, you know, so psychologically appealing. But the physiologic kick is coming from that added sugar. So what Gail is saying is that she's mitigated or reduced a little bit her sugar dependency, but it's still kicking in big when it comes to that decaf.
Right. And the fact that she's saying is that 1 or 2 cups a day is important to her mental well-being. I question that. Enjoy a cup of coffee, absolutely. But when you're saying something is important to your mental well-being, I'm a little bit worried about it.
You know what that's sort of saying? It's like, don't take it away from me or I'm going to go crazy on you.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing. Now, that's a statement of a little bit of, I really depend on that. You can't take it away because I won't be, you know, that's a little bit of dependency, maybe a little bit of addiction. And again, I bring to focus that it's a sugar delivery system more than anything. So Gail, I hope I've reframed it for you a little bit, something for you to think about. And yes, honey is as bad as sugar. Just because sugar is natural doesn't mean, you know, marijuana is natural. We're not supposed to have that either. Okay. So
I want to elicit a brief comment from you on the substitution of natural sweeteners. You know, there's so many out there. There's stevia, and now there's Truvia, which is a mixture of stevia and another type of sugar that is low calorie. It's sweet. I forget what.
Yeah, but it's still sugar. I think it's got some maltodextrin or something that in there. Truvia is not great.
Yeah.
Truvia is not great for that reason.
Yeah.
I think the only sugar substitute, and I think you'll agree with me, that we would like or even consider is xylitol. Because xylitol is also good for gum health, dental health, all of that other thing. We have to be careful with xylitol because any of the sugar alcohols like xylitol can cause a laxative effect if you overdo it.
Right.
So Gail, try a little xylitol, but if you're noticing any changes in your bowel habits, that might be the reason for it.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is try to break that sugar addiction altogether and just enjoy that beautiful cup of coffee for what it is.
And
a beautiful cup of coffee.
There are some studies that show that even drinkers of diet soda, some people think they get a pass with diet soda, that doesn't promote weight loss, that in fact it sort of stimulates your carbohydrate cravings. It's sort of like a tease. You know, it gets you kind of anticipating the carbohydrates coming down your food pipe.
Right.
But then when they aren't delivered, you seek outside sources of carbohydrates in a compensatory way, and therefore weight loss doesn't happen.
Yeah. In diet sodas in particular, most of them are sweetened with NutraSweet, with aspartame.
Horrible stuff.
And we know from the scientific literature that this still causes a rise in blood sugar and a rise in insulin. I can't tell you how many patients we have that who come in, they're doing a diet perfectly for weight loss, low carb, everything, but they're on a plateau. And I'm looking at their diet, and they finally reveal to me they're having, you know, a glass or a can of Diet Coke every day. Aha! Well, you just put yourself in fat storage mode every time you drink that. We take it away. Voila, the plateau is over. They continue to lose a little more weight. So, you know,
right.
Aspartame does the same thing to our blood sugar and insulin as sugar does, unfortunately. And it's also a neurotoxin. It's not great for the brain.
Right, yeah, we could do an entire program on the downsides of some of these artificial sugars. But let's move on. This one comes from, I don't know the name of this person. What do you think about using fecal transplant to deal with ulcerative colitis?
You go with that one. Oh.
You know, I would say you're not going to touch that with a 10-foot pole. You'd be at risk of punning. All right. So here's the deal. Fecal transplant, what in the heck is that? Well, actually, this has been done experimentally in people who are literally dying of a very serious type of infectious diarrhea called C. difficile diarrhea. Now, the problem with C. difficile, by the way, it's hospital acquired. It usually happens when elderly or immunosuppressed patients take too many antibiotics. It's epidemic in hospitals. It's very hard to prevent it. And it can cause a debilitating diarrhea. And now antibiotics barely even touch it. It's becoming antibiotic resistant. So, you know, it really takes a lot for standard medicine to consider giving literally transplants of feces to patients to cure them. You know, it's such an unappetizing concept, but these people have no other option. They're going to become emaciated and die of their chronic diarrhea. So they've taken a few people on a compassionate basis, and they've given them healthy fecal material from healthy individuals. They've administered it via endoscopy, in other words, the same thing that where you would get a colonoscopy, they've inserted it way up in the intestinal tract, and lo and behold, with a treatment or two or three, these people are cured. It's remarkable. You flip the switch on their intestinal flora, you put back beneficial bacteria, and they're cured. Now, this is a far cry from giving someone a probiotic, because a probiotic may have one or two, or, you know, at most, you know, we have Dr. Ahira's, which has 12 different species, but in your intestine you may have thousands and, you know, tens of thousands of different species of bacteria, adding up to trillions of bacteria in your intestine, and that's what you get from healthy flora or healthy microbiome in a healthy person. And so this has been considered and is under exploration for ulcerative colitis. And it appears to work in some of the initial experiments. I am planning to get one of the lead researchers on this subject. He's at my alma mater, my medical school, Albert Einstein College of Medicine. I'd like to get him on the air to discuss this. His name is Dr. Brandt. But they're doing this under very strict protocols. I understand that some people are bootlegging this procedure. You know, just like you can get plastic surgery in somebody's garage, and they'll do it, they'll put some, maybe some body filler into your buttocks or something like that, or, you know, some people are doing this in an ad hoc way. And in my opinion, this is not a good idea. By the way, it's a violation of the Food and Drug Administration regulations on this, because they now classify human feces as a drug, experimental drug. And so it has to be, if you're going to do this, it has to be done under a well-designed research protocol. And, oh, by the way, don't call the Hoffman Center and ask for this, because we're not doing it. But, you know, it's very promising. It's very interesting. It may ultimately be one of the ways that we can treat ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. I mean, the research really, we really need to pay attention to this.
Wow. Fascinating, fascinating.
Yeah.
That it could be cured in a few weeks from something like that, that's...
Well, you know, it speaks to the power of the microbiome, which is a word that, why don't you describe, you looked at some of the research and you attended a conference on the microbiome recently. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of emphasis on that in medicine.
Well, you know, actually at that particular conference at Mount Sinai, they were talking about the ethics more than anything, which was very, very interesting, because we're just starting to know that we are a superorganism. that we have more microbiota inside, outside of our bodies than we have cells in our entire body. Kind of takes a few moments to wrap your mind around that concept. And the fact that, you know, and if we're going to create, whether it's supplements or drugs or any other kind of pharmaceutical to make changes in that microbiota for health or to combat disease, it was talking more to the ethical questions about all of that being a superorganism. It was quite wild, actually. But wow. We're just finding out so many things.
Yeah, I mean, maybe there's questions as to, you know, whose property is it? I mean,
can you patent
this stuff? I mean, it basically is, I'm going to take, borrow somebody's microbiome and transplant it into myself. So can some company bankroll this and make a lot of money off it? I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
So, I mean.
And your microbiome being different than my microbiome and so on, and, you know.
Oh, here's another weird thing, is when they look for healthy volunteers, like, you know, let's say they say, okay, let's find someone to get this bacteria from. The person has to be healthy. The person cannot have any gastrointestinal ailments or infectious diseases, no HIV, no hepatitis, none of those things. And also the person has to be normal weight. Why? Because they're concerned that if you give the fecal transplant, if you obtain it from an overweight individual, it has the potential to make the skinny, emaciated, dying individual obese, because the bacteria have such pervasive effects that they can even influence metabolism and change the way you process calories. So that's kind of very interesting stuff.
Yeah.
All right, maybe forget ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. Maybe we'll be able to get fecal transplants for obesity.
That will be the next magic bullet. Yeah.
Hurry up and make that available. But, you know, as I say with many things, please don't try this at home. It's a caveat. All right. This one. My sister has diverticulitis. She has a mechanical heart valve and is on Coumadin. Would the garlic, gentian, olive leaf, oregano, and golden seal mess with her Coumadin level? Okay, so let's talk a little bit about, you know, reactions to certain supplements when you're on Coumadin. I think, you know, you can say a fair bit about that.
Coumadin is basically a blood thinner. Coumadin is actually warfarin, which is actually rat poison to some degree, which is interesting. But it's a blood thinner where patients have to be careful in terms of how much vitamin K they may get from vegetables and taking other blood thinning supplements, whether it's things like fish oil, like garlic, like ginkgo, things of that nature. So yeah, there may be things that would certainly interact with Coumadin that would have to be watched. Wouldn't have a patient on Coumadin and also have them take, you know, 9 soft gels of fish oil every day and also on an aspirin and so forth.
That would
be overkill.
The vitamin K might block the Coumadin, but the fish oil might further thin the blood, exaggerating the effects of Coumadin. Also, garlic has a little bit of a blood thinning effect. I see. What I say is there's no 100% contraindication to anything if you're on Coumadin, but you should, as is usually recommended, you get your INR checked or your ProTime checked, and you don't add a whole slew of mysterious supplements at once. You know, add them slowly and see if there's an impact, and then you can have your Coumadin dosage adjusted so that you can take the supplements that you want. I even give some patients vitamin K, and we introduce it slowly. And for most patients, it's not a problem. Or if it is, we, you know, just suggest their doctors slightly increase their Coumadin dosage so they can take the vitamin K. Vitamin K very valuable for osteoporosis, and also we're now learning for cardiovascular prevention.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, patients who are given Coumadin, you know, they're sent on their way. They're told by the nurse or somebody, don't eat vegetables.
Don't eat any vegetables.
Which is ridiculous. And I've had patients come in. No, I can't eat vegetables because I'm on Coumadin. Wrong.
Right.
You just have to make sure that you're not eating suddenly, you know, 5 servings of kale and spinach and broccoli a day as opposed to the 3 that you were having before, which is perfectly fine. So basically, you don't want to go too high or too low, but you want to stay consistent with the amount of vitamin K vegetables that they're taking in, pretty much.
That's key to consistency.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, this one's from Janice. In your experience, which is best for estrogen dominance, Dimpro or Indol-3-carbinol? Some reports say not to use I3C, that's Indol-3-carbinol, for too long. This is sort of a wonky question. You know, do you want to explain, Layla, you know, estrogen dominance?
Estrogen dominance primarily in women who either don't make enough progesterone or are in perimenopause, menopause, where progesterone is diminished and estrogen is basically on stage all the time. Women with estrogen dominance have a tendency toward uterine fibroids, possibly endometriosis, but more about uterine fibroids, fibrocystic breasts, things of that nature.
They feel heavy, they feel bloated, and many women notice, like, what's up with this? You know, I'm 45 or I'm 48. How come I'm going up in a bra size? I should be going down. They feel, sometimes moody and more emotional, like their PMS, which was just for 2 days, now is like most of the month. That's, you know, they're in hormone hell.
Great fun.
Right. But very common finding for us, and I think it's an important concept. So Dimpro and Indol-3-carbinol can be helpful for adjusting that. They are different versions of an extract of the cabbage family. And, you know, I got to say, well, I don't know what your view is on this, but I'm six of one, half dozen of the other. There's some – we use Dimpro, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
Which is diamond.
Among other things, yes.
Yeah. Among other things. And some people use I3C or Indol-3-carbinol, and there's sort of a war between the two camps. But, you know, to some extent, it's a proprietary war because the makers of Dimpro want to put down the Indol-3-carbinol and vice versa.
Oh.
And, you know, there are actually some products that combine both, you know, so you can hedge your bets. You can get a little bit of Dimpro and a little bit of Indol-3-carbinol together. I vote for Dimpro. Also, Dimpro and Indol-3-carbinol are very helpful for preventing the development of cancer from precancer. It appears that, especially in abnormal pap smears and maybe in a Barrett's esophagus, which is a precancer of the esophagus, that those are active. So we use a lot of Dimpro for that because, I mean, cabbage family has wonderful anti-cancer effects. So we use it for the female situation. We use it for cancer.
Yeah.
Anything else to add?
Other supplements for estrogen dominance, flax lignans, I like in Breval, and calcium D-glucarate.
Yes.
A particular form of calcium D-glucarate, is helpful in helping to remove excess estrogen.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be able to detoxify properly. That's really at the bottom of all that, too. All those excess
Don't drink alcohol, you know, because that'll raise your estrogen.
Right.
You know, like, keep me away from a woman who has PMS, who goes to a bar and drinks three cocktails, because that's that's a deadly mix. I mean, forget about it.
I mean, well, all right.
Talk about an estrogen storm.
Boy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, women notice, in particular, that they get very flushed sometimes with alcohol at certain times of the month. Their alcohol tolerance is reduced, and that's because their body's so tied up trying to process that extra estrogen. Men don't have to deal with that.
Also, women who are overweight.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
They're secreting a lot of estrogen from their fat cells as well. And then add the insult of alcohol on top of that, forget about it. That's like an estrogen.
And exercise will also somewhat bring down your estrogen. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you have excess estrogen, you're sedentary, you know, you're swimming in your hormones. If you exercise, you will sort of moderate the effects of estrogen. That may be actually the basis by which exercise prevents breast cancer. It's actually been shown that you really can run or walk for the cure to some extent because it actually helps to keep your excess estrogen in check.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exercise is also good for insulin sensitivity of the
yes.
cells, which is also a good cancer preventer. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yep. Mm-hmm. Today, big story. Oh, man, this is huge. And I think I posted this as soon as I got up. You know, I have a habit of sometimes I stay in bed and I use my, unfortunately, maybe from an electromagnetic standpoint, this is not so great, but I turn on my iPad and I read the stories of the day. And the story that struck me was a story that says that they just completed a study that shows that exercise is as effective or more effective than many of our commonly used drugs for diabetes, hypertension, and heart disease prevention. Big surprise?
Exercise is like taking glucophage.
Yep.
If glucophage, a.k.a. metformin, works by making our cells more sensitive to insulin. Exercise does the same thing. Now, to all the diabetics out there, don't throw out your metformin just because you hear us say that, but exercise absolutely is part of the prescription.
Yeah, here it is, British Medical Journal. Physical activity may be as effective as drugs. And they looked at, they actually found no difference between exercise and drug treatment for patients with coronary heart disease or prediabetes. And exercise is actually more effective than medication among patients recovering from a stroke. This is based on a small number of participants, only 339,000 participants.
Oh, I see.
A very small study, but, you know, how can we draw any conclusions based on that?
Right. We have to do more research.
Exactly. Let's just sit around and, you know, not exercise. And
we are meant to move. We are meant to move, and not from the sofa to the refrigerator. Yeah.
Speaking of moving, here's a guy who's in trouble because he of something that he's doing related to exercise. Dear Dr. Hoffman, I really enjoy your show on Saturday and now your podcast. So great, he's discovered our podcast. 46-year-old male, 5'10", 180 pounds, no meds, in good shape. Like you, I work out to stay fit, but recently I would experience severe headaches lasting a few hours to a day when I work out near maximal effort. Going for a couple-mile jog or weight training would not trigger these headaches, but when I do a CrossFit-type workout in which you do a workout with a pull-up, burpees, weights, I mean, that's like really intense, and you know, you get really gassed, you're really out of breath, and your heart rate goes way up. Trying to complete in the shortest amount of time, these workouts would trigger these headaches. So he went to the doctor. The doctor recommended an MRI. The MRI came back negative, and the only thing the doctor suggested was taking a break from these workouts that triggered these headaches. Would you know what causes these headaches? Is there anything you can do to mitigate or eliminate these headaches? That's a challenging question from Mike. By the way, he says the orthomolecular fish oil is vastly superior to the store-bought fish oils. Thanks for recommending it on your show. Wonderful product. And you can get that and all the products we talk about at drhoffman.com. I'll mention that because your support of drhoffman.com, and if you get products at drhoffman.com, that helps to subsidize these podcasts, which, in case you haven't noticed, are free and also commercial-free. All right, so the answer to Mike, I mean, this is tough because there are some people who have exercise-induced headaches. There are also some people who have, it's an unusual condition, but it's a very troublesome condition. They have headaches that are triggered by sex. And in some ways, these are similar because, you know, it's a form of exertion. You know, when you become sexually excited, you know, the blood vessels open up and you can get a headache. Your blood vessels dilate. And similarly with exercise, that may be the mechanism of exercise-induced headaches. They may be similar. These are tough to treat. What I would suggest is some monitoring in some way to see if blood pressure goes up very high during this CrossFit-type workout. Now, there are devices that your doctor can fit you with that will monitor your blood pressure during activity. And it may be that you have borderline hypertension that has to be addressed, and that it doesn't come out on, you know, just, you know, relaxed in the doctor's office, but that it happens when you exercise. I mean, everybody's blood pressure goes up when you exercise, but yours may go up super high, Mike. The other thing I would suggest is pay very close attention to your hydration status, because it may be that when you become slightly dehydrated, you're more likely to get these headaches. I mean, I'm not saying for sure, but that might be a concern.
That's an important point, dehydration. Yep. I mean, one of the first symptoms is a headache.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so I would be really pay close attention to hydration status. The other thing is that sometimes these types of exercise discomforts are the result of deconditioning. Now, you know, you seem like a very well-conditioned guy, but for this very high-level, high-intensity workout, you may be working up to a level of conditioning where you can better tolerate it. So I would suggest, you know, instead of plunging yourself into this very aggressive CrossFit workout, that you, you know, practice doing a short series of pull-ups and burpees and weights, perhaps with using a heart meter to measure your heart rate so that you don't, you know, overdo it. And then gradually segue to, you know, higher and higher levels of intensity as your fitness improves. Because, you know, isn't necessarily mean that anything's wrong with you. It just means that, you know, it's like a car, you know, when you put the pedal to the metal and, the RPM goes, you know, too high, you know, you put stress on the engine. And, sometimes you have to go a little slower. All right.
Okay.
This one, you got any more? You have any more on your
side? No, you go ahead.
Okay, this one, this is an interesting one. Barbara writes, my partner is an 85-year-old male who had aortic valve replacement surgery in 2007 along with a double bypass and a pacemaker. How smart is it for him to be eating eggs on a daily basis? He stopped taking all meds, including a statin drug, about 5 months ago. Well, Barbara's concerned about her 85-year-old partner because, she wants him to stick around.
How smart is it for him to be eating eggs on a daily basis?
Yeah.
It's very smart.
Thank you. So, you know, I think this goes to the heart of, you know, what we talked about earlier is this, this misconception that cholesterol and animal protein and even saturated fat are the cause of cardiovascular disease. And in fact, in the China study we previously referred to, the more men consumed animal protein, the less cardiovascular disease they had.
Yeah.
So, the alternative is for this gentleman to, you know, eat egg substitutes.
Which are terrible.
Which are terrible, right?
Yeah. They're all full of vegetable oil and salt.
Actually, I wrote my latest, if you check out my newsletter, and now we posted it on our website, the topic of my blog this week in the Intelligent Medicine newsletter is, what do Bill Gates, eggs, and Soylent Green have in common? And the column is about an attempt by Bill Gates and other Silicon Valley billionaires to develop a better alternative to eggs, which is going to be cholesterol-free and saturated fat-free, and it's going to save the planet. So
cause all kinds of disease, I'm sure.
Isn't that great? You know,
saving the planet.
Now that he has revolutionized our lives with computers that stall and have blue screens, and you know, he's gonna improve our nutrition.
He's not qualified to improve our nutrition.
But he's got a lot of money.
But he's got a lot of money, yeah.
And he's been very successful, so you know, why not tackle this? Anyway, so read about that. Look, here's the other thing. This guy's 85. He is at an age where statin drugs have actually not been shown to be particularly beneficial. And in fact, deleterious older individuals, passive surgery injury, are very susceptible to the weakening effects of statin drugs and also the memory effects of statin drugs.
Absolutely.
And there's the mother of one of our, I won't out her, I'll just make this anonymous, but the mother of one of our employees at the Hoffman Center was given a statin drug, and she's quite on in years. And her daughter, who is our employee at the Hoffman Center, says that my mom is like forgetful. She's clumsy since she's been on the medication, and we're not her doctor, but we're saying, hey, maybe think it over. Does she really need that statin drug? It's having side effects.
Exactly. And actually, I'm going to get into that at the Alzheimer's lecture.
Tell us about that. Yes.
Yes. The Alzheimer's lecture.
For this, folks,
dangers of statins, other things, but how to Alzheimer's proof your brain is the next seminar at the Hoffman Center on Wednesday, October 23rd at 6 p.m. You must reserve your seat, so do call our office, 212-779-1744, to reserve your seat for that seminar.
Okay.
And so, I look forward to seeing everybody there.
Great. Yeah. So, sign up. Don't show up, but sign up. Call the Hoffman Center. Go to drhoffman.com and find out about this great lecture, because I'll be there and I'll be co-presenting and fielding your questions in person at the Hoffman Center. That's 6 p.m. on, is it a Wednesday?
It's a Wednesday. Wednesday, October 23rd. Yes.
Okay, great. So I'm looking forward to seeing many of you there. And it's free for Hoffman Center patients. For those of you who are not patients, there's a nominal charge, but it's well worth it. You know, people come away very satisfied with lots of information, news that they can use to improve their health. All right, so that pretty much sums it up for today's edition of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I want to thank our guest and frequent contributor, Layla Mutin. who is
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
Nutritionist. And oh, by the way, if you want to see Layla at the Hoffman Center, you can see her together with me, or you can see her independently, and that's the route that a lot of people take if they don't need an extensive and sometimes more expensive medical workup. You can get a nutrition consult from Layla Mudin. So call Hoffman Center or check out drhoffman.com for information on how you can do that. Thanks again for joining us, Layla.
Thank you.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.